This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hello, everybody, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz. Got a very exciting episode for you today. I'm joined with my fabulous, wonderful, intelligent, just modeling how you usually do the intro, Kevin. My fabulous co-host, Kevin Holloway. Hi, Kevin.
I'm feeling all like validated. That's definitely how I think of myself every day.
That was my intention. That was absolutely my intention.
Perfect.
How are you feeling about today's episode?
I am excited. And partly because I mentioned this before we started recording, but you know, this almost feels like this fun role reversal, but also revisiting some of our favorite person, you know, like some of our favorite person, revisiting our one of our favorite people. Grammar's not my strong suit today. So
no, I think it's absolutely right, because the person who we have as our guest today is really a man of multiple identities and personalities.
Yeah. So that I thought you were going towards talents.
You're really only getting some of me. You're not getting all of me, just portions.
Dr. So Andy Santinello.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you recognize that voice, that's Andy Santinello. So, I mean, what I mean by role reversal is I can remember a couple of our episodes where Andy and I were the hosts and Corinne, you were the guest. So,
true story.
We're all back together. Got the band back together for this episode.
Welcome back, Dr. Andy Santinello. We are excited to have you here. How are you doing?
Thank you. Well, it's really good to be back. I know, you know, it's been a little while since we've kind of been together talking about stuff, and I'm excited to be back. I've been well. How have you guys been?
Good.
Good. Good. Hanging in there. Looking forward to the conversation. But yeah, you're right. It's been a little while. It's been, I don't know, a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Naturally missed you. You're a mess.
Missed you guys too.
Do you want to tell us what you've been up to as you've made your transition off the podcast and onto other things?
Sure. Yeah. So primarily, I've been doing just lots of therapy. So I'm the owner of Santinello Psychological Services in Baltimore, Maryland. So I've been really busy with that. And also, I was really lucky to have been offered an opportunity to continue with training and consultation in a different way with the ACT Academy, which is, I'll tell you about that in just a little bit, but I'm the Vice President of Learning and Professional Development for the ACT Academy now.
Ooh, nice. You fancy.
So it sounds really important.
Right. There's no salary attached to it or anything like that. I'm really excited about it. Myself and Amanda Rhodes, who is another Practical for Your Practice alum, if listeners remember her for, I think, a couple of seasons back, she started ACT Academy last year. And, you know, we actually met doing some consultation on one of my cases, and we have kind of a similar vision for training. And so she invited me to come on board, and we're just like really excited about what we're doing. So I can tell you a little bit about our mission and kind of what we're hoping to do, if that'd be helpful.
Yeah, I guess I should tell listeners that actually is the focus of our conversation today, is hearing about not only what you've been doing, but as you've been continuing your work in training and consultation, or to say it in a more fanciful fashion, dissemination and implementation, that maybe you have some lessons learned that you are willing to share with us, and we can have new a conversation insights. About that. New insights. Yeah. So, yeah.
All of those things, and maybe some, yeah, well, speaking of, what was the word you used?
Fanciful.
Hopefully not fanciful. Aspirational. like exciting ideas that I think we're trying to experiment with in ACT Academy in terms of dissemination and training. So yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
So our mission at ACT Academy is that we want to provide transformative training experiences that hopefully are going to harness the principles of contextual behavioral science. And Specifically, we're really committed to equipping individuals, organizations, and professionals with the tools and hopefully understanding that they need to navigate really complex human behavior, foster meaningful connections quickly, and also facilitate positive change. And we're hoping to do this by merging cutting-edge science with practical applications. And we aim to inspire really lasting personal and societal growth by helping individuals lead more fulfilling lives and hopefully creating this ripple effect of positive impact in the world. So that's just our modest mission.
Yeah,
that's very aspirational and very, when I say very aspirational, I don't mean like, you know, that's cool. You have goals. Good luck with that. But more of, you know, like that, having that as a purpose, I think is really important driving factor, not just, hey, we're going to do some training and help people learn act on this level, but thinking more expansively is really cool.
That sounds a little bit like, what is your why, right? Like, what, why are you doing this?
Yeah, we're trying to be really intentional about our values and our, you know, our aspirations and trajectory. We don't want to just be a continuing education company or something like that. We really want to, you know, think about and be thoughtful about the experiences we're creating to hopefully make a difference. And we also are very passionate about trying to create a space for anyone, everyone of really any level of experience and aspiration to learn. So from students who are maybe still in graduate school, all the way up to seasoned licensed professionals who maybe, you know, are interested in doing training themselves. So that's what we're hoping to do.
I don't know if all of our listeners get to what, I mean, everything you just said, every piece of that is so consistent with ACT, which is great as well. Like you're not just teaching things into so many things. It's woven into the very fabric of what you're talking about and how things are going. So like, if you're not at least surfacely level familiar with ACT, like that's where I'm at. And yet, I mean, as you're describing stuff, again, kind of, you know, we have values that we're following and we're wanting to have experiential impact, not just, you know, kind of knowledge impact. I mean, all of those things are very ACT consistent too. So I mean, I wanted to highlight it for those that are like me that would have been like, he said cool things. I don't know if that's, you know.
Yeah. Thank you for noticing that. And actually, I really appreciate that because we are trying to, again, be really intentional about practicing what we preach. You know, both Amanda and I are really passionate about the model. We use it in our own lives. We were having a conversation the other day and I said something like, you know, I'm going to need your help with this, but I don't want to overburden you. And, you know, I don't want you to start to resent me because I'm asking you to do stuff. And she said, well, that, you know, that's a reactive assumption. So let's just go ahead and label that, you know? And so we laughed about it. So, you know, but it's not acts by accident that those act consistent words are showed up in kind of our mission statement.
Yeah.
No, I noticed that you mentioned something that you're doing that's a little bit different than maybe what you did with CDP when you were full-time on board with us. Knowing that from our organization at CDP, we are often training actually mostly licensed professionals, sometimes students or behavioral health techs, et cetera. But we've got a very specific focus when we're working with folks who are working with our military-connected patients, right? So we have kind of a specific scope of practice, whereas it sounds like you have a much broader opportunity to meet a variety of people at a variety of levels of learning. And I wonder how that has changed how you teach and even maybe how you consult. Like what's different about that?
Just such a good question. There's opportunities in having that sort of broader audience and also some real challenges. And we're just getting started. So, you know, we're going to see what unique challenges come up, but already, you know, some of the things we've kind of dealt with is we have an international audience now. So we actually had our first workshop ever in November. We did something called ACT Practice Lab. Which was a lot of fun. And I think we're going to be doing more of those. But, you know, we had, you know, a couple of clinicians from South America, you know, contact us. And, you know, one of them was a student in an allied mental health profession. Another was, you know, a psychologist. And they were just sort of asking about how we might, you know, help them access the materials if English is not their first language. We had someone else who I think was a social worker in Italy who is going to be working in a unique setting that I hadn't, you know, known about before. So, and then we had, you know, kind of clinical psychologists, like we might have in a CDP training, and social workers. So I think the challenge is going to be finding ways to create opportunities that are hopefully specific enough to the folks that we're serving that are going to be good learning experiences, but also trying to tailor some of those experiences to folks who may have a different approach or sort of different function when it comes to mental health. So I'm excited. It's going to be really interesting. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to kind of come on the podcast and talk about some of the strategies and techniques and maybe approaches that we're hoping to use that might be a little bit more experiential than knowledge based.
Well, don't leave us hanging. Tell us about them.
Okay. I'll get into that in a minute, but I thought maybe it'd be kind of useful just to talk about dissemination in general of EVPs. And not just dissemination, but adoption and actual implementation. Because they're not, right? They're not the same thing.
You can sit in a 16-hour workshop and never do the treatment that you just learned, never have the opportunity to do it, never go back to the materials that you learned. It's one thing to sit in the workshop. It's quite another to put it into practice.
Absolutely.
And put it into practice competently too.
Like, yes. Yeah.
You know,
and continue to put it into practice after a short period of time, because, you know, so for example, I was kind of doing a little research before our podcast, and I was looking into studies that kind of examined adoption and implementation of EBPs in, for example, VA, which has spent lots of money and has developed some really fantastic training programs that have really high fidelity. They include a really high quality workshop developed by experts, 6 months of consultation. It's sort of the gold standard, what we would want folks to try to get if they're learning EBPs. And so one particular study I looked at was examining, you know, the consistency of implementation and adoption of EBP as sort of standard practice in clinicians in residential programs. And what they found was that essentially even clinicians who went through that whole process were fairly unlikely on a regular basis to implement EBPs. And when they were being implemented regularly, it tended to cluster around specific clinics where maybe there was a culture or practice culture that supported, you know, supported it, which I thought was kind of interesting. So, you know, like we assume, even if we do a really good job of training people, that that is then going to keep them motivated to use the skills that they've developed. And that's maybe not always the case. So,
yeah.
That's a bit disheartening. And you were making me think of, I learned a lot of, or I got a lot of my EBP training in the VA. And I agree that I was very much part of a clinic and a community that valued that and gave me the resources that I needed to do that. And so I feel really lucky. I also recognize that I had the motivation to do it, so that that same support existed for everybody who went through the training, but not everybody was doing, let's say, CBTI or CPT or whatever we were trained in. So it's a nice point to make that it's kind of both of those things. It's like you have to want to do it, first of all, but then you also have to be supported, an environment that supports you.
Well, I think about too, I mean, I know the three of us have talked about this in the past, that, that you know, there are different reasons that people attend workshops or any kind of training event. And in my mind, there's actually only a portion of those, and maybe it's a large portion, maybe it's a small portion, depending on the event or the topic, but there's only a portion of those that actually want to be there because they want to learn this material and implement it well. There's some, and let's be honest, I mean, I've certainly attended some training events where my motivation for being there is that I get a little certificate with a number on it that tells me how many CDs I have that I can report to my licensing board. And we all have to do some of that. And so not everybody at, you know, where like a didactic training event in particular, I think, are necessarily they're motivated because they're like, I really, really want to learn CBTI and implement it with fidelity or ACT or, you know, any number of things. There are some, there is hopefully, you know, a good portion of the audience that is there for those reasons, but there are also going to be those that are there because they need the CEs or because, you know, man, this is so much better than sitting in my office on a Wednesday or you know, whatever it may be.
Right. We're also talking about behavior change and maintaining behavior change.
If only we knew something about that, right?
Well, the thing is, we know a ton about it, and not a lot of it is being used, quite frankly, to help clinicians change and maintain new behavior. So, think about it. I don't know about you guys, but I have, my reminder list that nags me all of the time with just the basic things I need to get done. And it's important because, life gets busy and you might forget some of the things you need to do, like, hey, I'm going to exercise today, or I need to, make sure I eat something, or, stuff like that. You get to sleep on time. So we have these, devices that nag us and remind us all the time. Another thing that can fall off the radar really easily is what really, really, truly matters to us when we're stressed. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking about frontline clinicians, they experience some stress. So, it could be really tough to even remember that you care, which is tricky. I think the biggest maybe problem in dissemination science at this point is we're treating the issue of EBP dissemination and implementation as solely a knowledge problem. The idea is that we think that if we get really good, competent trainers who have lots of experience and are good presenters and get good materials and give clinicians the right information through workshops and self-study and consultation and other knowledge delivery methods, that they're going to adopt EBPs in their practice and they're going to do them consistently and competently. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of an outgrowth of our, predominant education system. It's all about knowing stuff and then spitting it out. So we're treating what's essentially a doing problem, actually doing EBPs, as if it were a knowing problem. And there's a big difference between knowing about something and be able to do it.
For sure.
There's examples of that in all over everyday life.
Right. Yeah. And we wouldn't treat, if somebody was memorized a recipe book, but they couldn't cook, we wouldn't confuse that person with a chef. Even if they could report all that stuff back to us. And I'm thinking about a consultation session, kind of to that point where a colleague of mine was telling me about, he received a videotape from somebody and was reviewing their session. And this person, this clinician who had just learned this particular therapy, spent nearly the entire session talking. And they were presenting metaphor after metaphor, more information, like bits of information after bits of information. And then they got to the end of the session and they essentially hadn't done the treatment. They'd just been talking about it the whole time. And this, this consultant friend of mine said that, he was toying with giving the feedback that it actually would have been more consistent with the model if the clinician was silent the entire time. Mm-hmm. So knowledge problem. This person has worked really hard to memorize all this stuff, and they are actually not doing the treatment, but think they are because they're talking about it.
Right.
You know what strikes me about that is that as you're talking about that, I'm like, well, of course, so many of us, as therapists, would be like, of course, that's not good therapy. And of course, just spouting knowledge at your client, like trying to teach therapy or trying to, the principles we're trying to work on in therapy, if we treat that like a knowledge problem rather than a doing problem, I think all of us would agree like, oh, that's a waste of time. We're not just going to be throwing facts at clients. But we tend to lean that direction when it comes to disseminating how we interact with clients, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of I love that comparison there, a knowing problem versus a doing problem. In the context of therapy, as a therapist with a client, us treating that like it's a knowledge problem, we would all agree is dumb, or at least not terribly effective, right?
Right.
And yet that's the way we tend or lean towards when we're talking about dissemination and implementation.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic.
Yes, to say the least.
Well, you are core questioning everything that we think we know about dissemination and implementation, everything that we've been doing for decades at this point. So I'm hoping you didn't come here just to make us feel bad.
I did. That was my primary.
Thanks for listening.
So give up, everyone.
I'm hoping maybe you have some things that you've tried to do differently that have worked.
I have. And before we move on to that, though, it's not that is not our training methods are not helpful because,
oh,
you know, well, but I know, and I want to say that, and there's been some, like, you know, interesting, I kind of reviews that have been done lately, and I'm going to include a couple of references in the show notes about this, but essentially really good EBP training tends to lead to pretty good improved short-term provider knowledge, mm-hmm. Maybe some skills, you know, maybe better adherence. Especially when it's compared to not getting training or self-study, and depending on the intensity of the training model in terms of how much practical experience someone gets with the skills, the more likely it is that the clinician is going to be able to learn those skills and implement them in a way that makes difference for their clients. So it's not that we're doing it all wrong. I don't mean to say that.
Thank you.
Still have a job, Corinne.
Oh, phew. It's so close. It's always so close.
But the point was well taken that we're doing a lot of things right. There's a lot of good happening, but it could be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Could be better. And I don't think this means we need to radically change, you know, the modalities we're already using. I think it might just be, you know, adding some additional elements here and there that really allow people to get their hands on these skills and practice them in a sort of safe and productive environment, kind of a sandbox type environment where it's more about playing with the stuff and seeing what works and get some expert feedback. And then, you know, create some, you know, communities of practice, if you want to call it that, or ways of allowing people to reconnect with their values and continue to practice and hone their skills over time. So I don't think it's going to take tons of stuff to do. And I don't think it needs to happen at really high levels. I think it can happen more organically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sounds very experiential. Once again, in line with ACT.
Right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So why experiential training? I mean, because that's the way we learn to do skills. That's the way we learn behavior. I was talking with another ACT trainer about this about a month ago, and we were kind of talking about this issue. And, you know, I was giving a critique on a training I went to, and I said, I wish there was more experiential, you know, methods in here, because it's hard to change behavior just by, you know, learning new information. And he said, I would submit that it's actually not possible to learn new behavior unless you actually practice it and have contingency shape it.
Yeah.
And I think he, to a certain extent, is right. So the good news is there's already some pretty good models of how to incorporate experiential training already just like right in some of the traditional modalities that we use. And I wanted to kind of mention a couple of them today and maybe talk about what we're hoping to do more of in ACT Academy.
Yeah, please.
So one of the coolest models of experiential training I experienced was several years ago, before I came to CDP, I went to a mindfulness-based cognitive therapy teacher training up at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York. And it was a really interesting workshop. It was week long, and it was a combination sort of almost like meditation retreats, but then they walked us through the whole protocol each session. And then we did these things called teach backs. And teach backs were essentially, we paired up in small groups of two or three, and we took turns essentially leading each other through these different exercises. Mm. So we got immediate feedback from our peers. The facilitators were walking around and they gave us feedback. And then we got to sort of be in the role of, you know, person leading the meditation and see what that's like. So we could sort of learn by vicarious learning and modeling, but also getting expert feedback. Mm-hmm. So really easy type of thing to adapt for the workshops that we're doing in other EBPs, these sort of teach back models. It's kind of the see one, do one, teach one.
Yeah, it sounds like a level above kind of the standard role plays that we often do, like a more a deeper level of learning than what we frequently do, which is model how you would introduce this to a client. Okay, and now you model it, and we'll give each other feedback. This seems, am I understanding it correctly, that this is taking that to a deeper level.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. It's not like a set piece, practice this bit of rationale and saying it out loud, and then let's switch roles. Or here's a case write-up that of a hypothetical client. It's more, let's actually do these interventions with mm-hmm. each other as if it were the real thing.
Like mm-hmm. real plays, perhaps?
Real plays, yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Which is another experiential method that when I was still at CDP, we were using in the ACT trainings that we did, mm-hmm. And also tends to be a standard, feature of a lot of ACT workshops, is you get together and you sort of practice these, skills on each other. Mm-hmm. And it makes it a little bit more easy to engage. It's more real. You can start to see at sort of a personal level how these different interventions might work with a client, and you get a feel for what it's like to be on the other end of it. And then you can give feedback about like, is this working or not based on your experience of what the person is doing?
Yeah.
So that's a, real plays are another example. And there's a really great model of how to do this in a peer-to-peer consultation group. And it's we'll include the reference in the show notes by Brian Thompson and Jason Loma and some of their colleagues out at the Portland Psychotherapy Center. And they've dubbed their consultation model the Portland model.
Cool.
Right. And a big part of that model is every single consultation session includes, these real plays where maybe there's a specific, for example, like ACT process. Maybe we're going to practice diffusion today. And so one person will be sort of in the designated role of case presenter. And that's the term they use for client. Mm-hmm. And the other person will be in the role of skill builder. And that's the name they use for therapist. And then they kind of just practice while the rest of the group kind of watches. And then there's a sort of a consultant there. If the skill, the person practicing skill gets like stuck, and they can jump in. And then the whole group kind of talks about together what worked and what didn't. And then every week that pair changes. So everyone gets a chance to practice. Everyone is sort of in the same boat. Everyone kind of gets used to making mistakes and learning from them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's really, you got me thinking, of course, about the EBPs that I teach and how do I apply this? Because this sounds like such a nice shift and such a useful potential shift. And it seems easy for me to imagine how to incorporate some of this into an EBP workshop on CBT for insomnia, for example, where we could sit and each of us could fill out a sleep log, and talk about what that process is like and et cetera, or do some of the other sleep related skills, because everybody can relate to sleep, right? And I can absolutely imagine it working in an ACT workshop as well. I'm struggling a little bit, and maybe you can help me, or maybe you can tell me, no, you're putting me on the spot. I don't want to answer that. I'm trying to imagine how that could play out in, let's say, a trauma-focused treatment workshop, like prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, where we don't necessarily want people to talk about their traumas in the workshop or really painful things.
Well, and I had a related question. Maybe you can either say, no, that's a different question. I'll answer that in a moment. But, because I like this. I really love the idea of working on these skills together. And, where's that line between doing this work experientially together and having that feedback and getting free therapy in a potentially weird context,
Right.
Really good questions. Let me see if I can remember Corinne's first and then remind you of your question.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, because that's an important one. And especially if we're going to do things like real plays where we're bringing our own stuff into mm-hmm. the room.
Right.
Well, doing something like imaginal exposure, the essential skill that we want a therapist, well, there's lots of skills inside of that. But the main one maybe we want the therapist to work on is, can they be with a client and invite them to talk about a difficult memory and to mm-hmm. stick with it in the present moment and report on the thoughts and feelings they're having.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound like a fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
From the client side, if we're going to do a real play, it doesn't really matter what the memory is.
Mm.
You could have the person talk about, a minor inconvenience in a lot of detail.
Okay.
And so it doesn't have to be this majorly distressing thing. The thing we're practicing for on the therapist side is, can you keep the client engaged with that memory, keep them in the present moment, and keep them talking about what their experience is?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And being there with them.
And being right,
not trying
them.
To fix it for them or trying to shut it down and pull it back. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Exactly.
And I guess there's a corollary with CPT, let's say. We don't have to have somebody do a real play on a truly traumatic stuck point or negative thought. We can have them do it on a negative thought about a minor inconvenience or something they're upset with in a minor way. Like, I hate the guy who took my parking spot in the
right.
Not right. Using a personal
so that's
example
a major trauma for me,
at
but...
all. At yeah. all.
I should have known better if I left right. earlier.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Yeah. The content, I think, is less important than the process. You know, mm-hmm. if we know what we want clinicians to practice, then we can give them guidelines about what types of content it might be helpful to talk about. Another powerful way of doing this is just modeling. So one of the things that I do a lot in my ACT workshops and, continue to do in consultation also is if I'm going to ask the group to practice a skill, I'll usually, with a co-presenter or a volunteer, model what I want that to look like. So, mm-hmm. for example, there's a little exercise that we do in sort of the standard ACT workshop. The intro is, which is having clients learn something called the ACT conceptualization tool. It's basically learning, it's a 4x4 matrix and learning about some of the different things you might want to be assessing for and paying attention to when a client talks about a case, like experiences they would rather not have, values, things like that. And so, I'll usually real play that, and I'll ask the person I'm real playing with if they're, you know, in the role of client to maybe talk about, like you said, a minor inconvenience or maybe something they're procrastinating on doing, you know, going to the DMV or something.
Right.
I'm currently procrastinating going to the DMV.
We're all using our personal
So this is
examples.
Our real play right now.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, the advantage of a real play, I think, is that it gets the person who's in the role of case presenter more interested, and they're going to be more engaged, and it's going to feel they're more invested. And also for the person who is in the role of skill builder, it's more interesting experience. It's a real life human being here talking about some real feelings and thoughts. And, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to, learn some things that could be helpful with, you know, different content that might be like a traumatic memory or something like that.
Yeah. You know, and in many ways, as you're answering Corinne's question, you're answering mine too. I mean, and that is really we don't need to get into what would be, you know, kind of the domain of or the content of therapy in order to do these or have these experiences to engage in these activities in a meaningful way, in a very learning kind of a way, which is gratifying. I mean, I think that's where sometimes I've heard and maybe even felt, you know, some pushback for some of this experiential learning, because it's kind of like, you know, we've all said this during workshops, so we've all taught like, hey, this is not the time for free therapy, don't be, right. You know, and but then there is this level of distance where, you know, as you were saying, it is more about, you know, how do we put our words together to say the thing we meant to say rather than what are those essential skills. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate that, because I'm thinking at this point already, I'm thinking like, man, I want to like radically change the workshops that right. I do, you know, or at least the breakout, you know, exercises that we've been doing, but a lot to think about. I know we've had conversations like this before too. And so it's again, a reminder that there's some really effective, helpful things we can be doing in our own work, our own practice, and even as we're working on disseminating to others. So.
That seems like a good transition to some actionable intel, wouldn't you say, Kevin?
I think so. Now, I'll give a preamble for our listeners' sake if you're just joining us for the first time ever, because Andy's not, and he knows what this is. But you know, at the end of each of our episodes, we like to have, you know, a couple of points, some tips, things that you can do following this episode right now, applying to your practice and to the work that you do. You know, that's what Practical for Your Practice is all about. So, Andy, what are a couple of points, a couple of take-home tips people who have been listening to this episode can incorporate?
Yeah, really quickly, I just want to speak to that last issue about free therapy. Number one, if you're going to use, well, and I guess this is a actionable intel. If you're going to use experiential methods, make sure you do good informed consent. Especially
really good point.
You know, you're going to include real plays, and not just at the beginning of your workshop, but before every experiential exercise. You want to reinforce over and over again. People are more than they have all the say in how much they want to disclose and in what way. You also need to, number two, I think, make sure you set an expectation of safety and confidentiality. Again, do that over and over again. I think it doesn't, the other piece of actionable intel is this doesn't, you don't have to radically change things. Maybe if you're in a role of a trainer or a supervisor or a consultant, you just might want to think about how can you take maybe some of the ways that you're speaking about interventions and create an opportunity to practice and do that in real time. And it doesn't have to be huge. So one example is in ACT Practice Lab. I asked a bunch of my fellow ACT trainers if they could send me a 30-second clip of them demonstrating one of the psychological inflexibility processes. Like, show me what fusion might look like. And then as a group, what we did is we showed these 30-second clips, and I had folks say, what do you think that is? And let's talk about it. Or what would you say in response to that to sort of reflect back that you thought this might be, fusion, and then how might you invite the client to practice defusion? So it doesn't have to be big. It could just be, little tweaks like that.
Yeah.
And I guess if you're a clinician, you've kind of noticed this sort of, you've got a lot of knowledge and it hasn't translated into doing, I would say check out one of our experiential workshops or in the feedback you give to presenters, ask them for these types of experiences. If you're asking for them, it's more likely that in the future they're going to be incorporated.
Really appreciate that. I think those are all fantastic points. I'm already, my gears are turning about what to do differently, maybe the small tweaks that we can make to the stuff that we do here at CDP, but also, of course, as we've said a number of times throughout the episode, we'll have links and information and things about the resources that Andy's mentioned so that you all that are listening can check them out.
I think it's a sign of a good podcast episode where I'm thinking, I want to be done with this episode so I can go now apply
and do
what
things,
we just talked about. Like, I have things now on my to-do list that I need to get done because Andy made some great suggestions. So I think that's a sign of a really helpful discussion and a really helpful episode. So Kevin, do you want to tell listeners a little bit about how they can get in touch with us?
We really, I love that because that's consistent with the theme of interaction and experiential, right? We really want to hear from you all. Like, we don't want this to be a one-way communication on our podcast. So we want to hear from you all, interact with us. And there's a number of ways to do that, but probably one of the easiest is to leave us a voicemail message. So at speakpipe.com/CDPP4P, you can leave us a voicemail there, ask us a question or react to an episode that you just listened to or have suggestions for future topics, go ahead and drop us a line. If you'd like, we can include the audio recording in a future episode, or if you prefer, we can just tell people what you told us, whatever it is. But we'd love to hear from you. We really want to know what's important to you so that we can respond to that.
Thanks, Kevin, for that. I always trip over my words when I try to give that SpeakPipe address. So I appreciate you saying it.
And that'll be in the show notes too, of course.
Yes, of course. But thank you for a great episode. Like I said, I want to wrap up and go put some of this actually into practice, experiential practice, if you will. So thank you, Andy.
Thank you so much.
Friend of CDP forever. Thank you for coming back and joining us for a great discussion.
Yeah, it was awesome. I really appreciate you guys having me back, and I really enjoyed our discussion today.
And I hope this isn't the last time we have you on again, too. We got to the end of this episode. I'm like, what? We're done? There's just so much more to talk about. So
agreed.
Yeah, I'd be happy to come back.
Awesome. We have it recorded. We have proof that Andy would be happy to come back. So everybody,
and
tune
lots of
in
witnesses
in
now too.
That's exactly right. Tune in the future. Thanks everybody for joining us. Thanks Kevin for being my co-host today.
Of course. Thanks everybody.
Bye everyone.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.